On November 5th, 2019, at Bozeman's independent bookstore, The Country Bookshelf, local best-selling author Gary Ferguson read from his latest book, The Eight Master Lessons of Nature, What Nature Teaches Us About Living Well in the World, published by Dutton. He was joined at times by his partner, cultural psychologist Mary Claire. Gary Ferguson is introduced by The Country Bookshelf's Marissa Fessenben.
I'd like to welcome Gary Ferguson. Gary is a well-recognized author. He has written for national publications such as Vanity Fair, Orion, the Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and authored 24 books on nature and science. He wrote an essay called A Deeper Boom that was published in Orion, and that won recognition from the American Society of Journalists and Authors as the best essay of 2017. In the essay, he sort of delves into boomer culture and sort of the need for people to have a reconciliation between what has happened and what they've done and the impending climate crisis that we find ourselves in, and how we need to all cultivate and heal our relationship to the earth and build a meaningful existence. So from everything that I've read of Gary's, including some of this book, The Eight Master Lessons of Nature, if you want to connect to and be inspired by humans' relationship with nature, Gary is your man. So,
thank you, Marissa. This is really such a pleasure for me to be here sincerely tonight. I believe I started reading at the Country Bookshelf probably in 93, 94, and have been here many times. But this is the first time I have read here as a resident of Bozeman. Mary and I moved here about a year and a half ago, and we're so thrilled with this community. It's got such a big brain and a giant heart, and a big part of that heart that I've felt as well as the brain has been in Country Bookshelf. And so thank you to the staff here who makes this such a precious resource, one of the best independent bookstores in the West, as far as I'm concerned. And we're really, really lucky to have them here. So thank you. And thanks for, I know there are a lot of things going on tonight, so you could have been across the street, you could have been at the Blackbird, you could have been all kinds of places. So thanks for being here. You know, I want to tell you a little bit about this book. I should probably start by saying I think it has something to do with me getting old. I don't know how it happened or when it happened, but it is happening. And a couple of years ago, I sort of looked over my shoulder and I wanted to just review for myself what all my years in very wild places had taught me, what the various biologists, the men and women who were ecologists, biologists, botanists, geologists, had taught me, what some of the wise indigenous folks I had the pleasure of hanging out with patiently tried to teach and help me understand and see. And I think I've reached an age where putting those things together, asking what is it that nature has to tell us, is what led to the Eight Master Lessons of Nature. There, eight is not a magic number. That's just when I started listing them, what I came up with. But not just these processes that make nature unique and marvelous and deserved of our wonder, but what is going on in the world at large that we too can take lessons for how to live our lives both individually and in community. Because one of the things we forget is we are nature. This is really about reclaiming our human nature. We are the natural world, and that means we've got a lot of the superpowers that nature at large has, and we can employ them to not only meet the challenges of climate change, but live a more sustainable and contented and generous, compassionate, kind life. And so I'm not going to be able to get into all of these lessons today. There are lessons about connection and diversity, mystery, the essential power of the feminine, which is a lesson that's just exuded by nature. And for 4,000 years, we've more or less suppressed that particular reality of life. I think it's one of the great mistakes we've made in human history. I talk about how elders pass down knowledge and wisdom in all kinds of animals, and even arguably in some tree communities, from the oldest beings to the youngest, how nature thrives after a major disruption like a fire? What is there for us to learn about that? But I'm only going to be able to talk to you about a couple of these tonight. And I thought I would just offer you a smattering of very short readings mixed with some conversation off the page. I don't want to just read everyone to sleep. So I'll keep those to a minimum and then and talk between those selections. So with that, let me just start with the intro so you'll have a little bit better understanding of where we're coming from and where we're going. There was a time long ago when the supple reach of trees and the whisper of water bore deep comfort, when the ringing of birds and the mutter of frogs reminded us to take heart in the fact that whatever else was happening, we were all still here, rising strong in the morning, faces to the sun. We knew the juice of spring then, surging in the wild rose and the fig, and in us too. We could feel it as if we were somehow wed to the tender shoots, as if our own breathing was the great green breath of earth, a time when a person barely knew where she ended and the world began. The shouts, the songs, the purring and the whirring, all of it an astonishing conversation. From where we stand now, it can seem like a dream, but every so often, out of nowhere, the thrill of that old dance judders in our bones. It reawakens sensations we had within easy reach when we were young, still wide-eyed for the world. My own inklings of such things came during a boyhood spent in the Midwest in a small city in northern Indiana, nursed on corn and casseroles and steel, a place where nature got served in teaspoons. A garden behind our house about the size of two couches laid end to end, where I first stood barefoot and watched the comings and goings of butterflies and bees. A slim ribbon of grass where in the twilight of summer I scurried about with a jam jar scooping up lightning bugs. And the sidewalks of 27th Street, walking home from school on some gloomy April afternoon with the wind in the maples thrilling to big booms of thunder thunking inside my chest. Around age 11, I started riding my purple stingray 10 blocks west of Pottawatomie Park, a place laced with lines of oaks and maples with trunks so big I couldn't reach even halfway around them. And nearby, a greenhouse with a banana tree and orchids and an avocado tree, and next to that, a pocket zoo with a geriatric lion, six crowing peacocks, a display of roaches, really, and a snorting donkey. As I have in adulthood spent some 40 years waltzing through some of the world's wildest places, drifting along more than 30,000 miles of trail through the outback, you might imagine I'd think of these modest encounters with nature when I was young as, well, quaint. But no, they were big. In their own way, as vital as the yawning savannas of East Africa or the high lonesome roll of the Yellowstone backcountry or the cold quiet reaches of the Arctic tundra, the lightning bugs and the bees and the giant oaks at Pottawatomie Park are what cracked me open, what introduced me to the ebb and flow of the world, to the daily playlist of chirps and buzzes and snorts and whooshes, not just piquing my curiosity, but also leaving me with the extraordinary sensation of being a part of it all. The chrysanthemums in the flower box under my bedroom window were somehow set to my own bright sense of summer. The cardinal in our maple tree wore a dazzling feathered suit that was my color of red. The mourning dove in the apple tree beside Carl and Yvonne Wilson's driveway cooed a song that even on first hearing was somehow familiar, reassuring. No matter where you are, who you are, where as a child you happen to live, more than likely you too took some of your first steps toward growing up and growing out because nature charmed you into the precious work of unfolding. Whether it comes in big helpings of the wild, or as a spider web in the corner of your garage, or even as dandelions growing out of the cracks in the sidewalk, nature calls to each of us. And here's the thing. Despite what you might have been led to think, such magic doesn't just disappear, quietly drifting forever out of reach. After all, as we go through the various stages of our lives, we keep adding to what's come before rather than replacing it. Wherever you are now, however urban or interior your life, nature is still there for you, anchoring, inspiring, helping you become more of what it is you set out to be. At the same time, the natural world remains a ready source of essential lessons, each one helping us better understand what life really needs in order to thrive. As much as anything, this is a book about coming home. Not just back to where you grew up, not only to the suburban split level with the clipped lawns and the cement birdbath, not just back to the brick apartment building or the small white craftsman house on a tree-lined street in the heart of the city, not only back to the old farm with the barn and the green tractor and the moon-eyed cows. No, this bigger, deeper home has to do with the profound belonging that comes from recovering your natural camaraderie with the wonder of the planet. A number of years ago, while teaching a nature writing class in Yellowstone National Park, I had the great pleasure of having as one of my students Sister Helen Prejean. By the time we met, Sister Helen had already gained acclaim for her work helping the severely troubled and down and out, including her correspondence with two convicted murderers, Elmo Saunier and Robert Willie. Those conversations ended up being the genesis for her remarkable book and later the movie Dead Man Walking. On our final day together, the group was out hiking along the Specimen Ridge Trail toward Amethyst Mountain, the land before us awash in glorious views of the Serengeti-like grasslands of Yellowstone's Lamar Valley, clusters of bison milled about the valley floor, small groups of pronghorn rested along the edges of the aspen woods, while overhead, red-tailed hawks pirouetted on the wind. At one point, pausing to savor the view, Sister Helen brought up the religious concept of annunciation. I'd only ever heard the word used in doctrinal terms, as in the Christian celebration of the angel Gabriel telling Mary she was destined to give birth to the Son of God. But Sister Prejean had a much broader take. She said that to her, annunciation was the act of making something fresh, of bringing an ideal more fully to life by making it real in our everyday world. Held in her take on annunciation lies a beautiful opportunity to respect the planet in the way the ancient Greeks defined respect, which was to look again. Indeed, the time is very much here to look again, and in doing so, to begin putting the world back together. Before I get into a few thoughts, I wanted to take a moment to introduce my brilliant wife, Mary Clara, social cultural psychologist. And I want to do that because it was, in fact, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of miles of walking together, talking about these ideas that really helped shape them. Mary, being a cultural psychologist, has been essential at helping figure out how one takes what we see going out on in the world, what ecology recognizes as the brilliant ways that nature thrives, and incorporating them into our daily lives. And that's a subject that she's passionate about and very good at marshaling. So this book owes a great deal to her, and I want to thank her for that. Bringing nature's lessons home, like I was just talking about in the work that Mary and I do, increasingly with something we've named Full Ecology, which is taking this book to the next level, basically, it requires a switch in perception, a change in perception. And for many people, that shift of perception gets energized to the extent they have a relationship with mystery. Now, that sounds all woo-woo, but the fact of the matter is, it's where this book begins in mystery, and it's also a concept that's not just celebrated by theologians or philosophers, but indeed a great many scientists have claimed that their work really couldn't have proceeded without having a deep relationship to mystery, whether it was Rachel Carson or Jane Goodall or Carl Sagan or this particular guy who lived a story that I just find extremely fascinating, and it made me look back at mystery and how deeply I was tending that relationship in my own life. When Albert Einstein got stuck on a problem, and truth be told, he got stuck quite a bit, he'd often go outside, not to some remote wild landscape, but to a little patch of forest on the Princeton campus maintained especially for him, known as the Institute Woods. You might assume he was merely trying to clear his head, as a lot of us do when we step out for a quick change of scenery, but it's a more intriguing story. Once out in those familiar woods, Einstein was said to stop and look around, taking in the trees and shrubs, the sky overhead, and the grasses underfoot. At first, he'd try to imagine the workings of it all, knowing full well he couldn't do it. Consider that even today, more than 60 years after his death, we still don't fully understand everything that's happening in a square yard of dirt, let alone a patch of woods. But that was the point. He wanted to intentionally overwhelm himself, get disoriented, blow his mind. And thus, with his intellect brought to its knees, Einstein consistently found himself in a freer, more intuitive space. Look deep into the mysteries of nature, he liked to say, and then you will understand better. If we're to make friends again with mystery, we'd be smart to learn something about where it likes to show up. One place it feels totally at home, of course, is in the arms of wonder, which is lucky because, in truth, we live in a time of extraordinary scientific wow. Who wouldn't be a little thrilled to learn that spiders can fly by employing electrical charges in the atmosphere? Standing on their hind legs, they cast silk into the air. That silk is negatively charged and repels similar negative charges in the surrounding atmosphere, sending the spiders ballooning into the heavens. Or who wouldn't feel a twitch of bewilderment to think that 99.9999% of our body is comprised of the empty space that exists between the electrons, neutrons, and protons, each one of those an element of the atoms that give us form? Furthermore, if you got rid of all this space, then the actual mass of your body, your substance, would be so small you couldn't even see it. In fact, if we took away all the space in all the bodies of every human being on the planet, the mass that remained would be about the size of a sugar cube. Think, too, for a minute about the fact that as you walk down the street today, you won't really be making contact with the ground. Rather, the magnetic force of the electrons in your shoes will be pushing away the electrons in the pavement, which means that at a supremely close-up level, you really aren't walking through your life with your feet on the ground at all. You're floating. And then, of course, that old favorite, the fact that you could blast off from Earth on a journey to find the end of space, travel 100,000 miles an hour for the next 10,000 years, and not be one inch closer. Or how about the extraordinarily curious fact that any of us is here at all? If the gravity in the universe had been stronger by just a tiny bit, then the stars that formed because of that gravity would have been much smaller. Our own sun might have lasted for only 10 or 20,000 years, fizzling out long before we humans or any other creature had a chance at life. Likewise, if the strength of the force that binds the nucleus of an atom were just a wee bit weaker, there wouldn't be the current range of chemicals in the universe, and without that perfect array of chemical complexity, no life. Far from disenchanting nature, as early scientists of the 17th century pledged to do, contemporary biology, physics, medicine, and ecology are admitting its enchantment all over again, inviting us with every passing year to perceive a more unbridled universe. In recent decades especially, scientists have found themselves looking beyond the desire to hold reality still, drawn instead to the mysterious and fluid nature of the planet and the life it contains, showing us with every passing day how the physical and even psychological functions of this life are vigorous, dynamic, and effervescent. And yet, you know, when it comes to embracing mystery, which I highly recommend, like Einstein or Rachel Carson or Carl Sagan or Jane Goodall has done, there's a bit of a fly in the ointment for most of us, myself included. And it has to do with this all-consuming and yet highly limited way of seeing the world, of how the world works, of understanding the world and calling it reality. And it's something that took home, that we took home with us a long time ago. It's been passed down generation to generation until it's very much like the water that fish swim in. We don't even see it anymore. And I want to give you a little taste of what it looked like when it was first anchoring itself throughout Europe and would spread across the next many hundreds of years. And like I said, again, has become the water in which we swim. We need to get beyond this limited vision, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. The story goes something like this. Nearly 400 years ago, a bitterly cold night in the Netherlands. The air is stung through with hard wind and sheets of snow, yet the weather hasn't stopped throngs of students bundled in waistcoats from filling the stately Utrecht University auditorium, eager to hear a lecture by a man widely touted as the most intelligent human on the planet. His name is René Descartes. And while for years he's been celebrated as a philosopher and mathematician, tonight people have come because of his growing reputation as a cultivator of science. An intellectual whose tireless rational inquiries have allowed him to divine God's master plan for the universe. Beyond the flickering light of the whale oil lamps ringing the stage, a professor in a black frock struts out to quiet the crowd, announcing in a booming voice that the brilliant René Descartes will soon appear and transform the way they see the world. And what's more, the professor says, some in the audience might be astonished by the power of what they're about to hear. The professor squares his shoulders and exits. 5 minutes pass. Then Descartes strolls regal into view. Following him onto the stage is a sluggish yellow dog. On Descartes' command, the dog lies down in front of the podium, his head between his front paws, staring past the oil lamps into the darkness. Halfway through the lecture, deep into describing the workings of the universe as one might explain the gears and springs of a clock, Descartes pauses. He stretches out an arm, the index finger of his hand pointing to the rafters as if to hallow his proclamation that humans are the only species capable of deciphering the genius of the Creator. Humans are exceptional, he says. We are chosen. And not only is every other creature inferior in intelligence, but none has emotions or thoughts or even the capacity for physical sensations. It's at that moment when Descartes walks around to the front of the podium and kicks his dog. The dog squeals. Against an audible gasp from somewhere in the audience, he holds the palm of his hand. He smiles like a patient father. This I can tell you with certainty, he might have said. Modern study has affirmed that no creature on earth, save humans, has any ability to feel pain or fear. What you are seeing is called an automatic physical response. Because of its limited nervous system, the dog experiences no discomfort whatsoever. Then, to emphasize his point, Descartes kicks the dog again. While we may be horrified at the thought of a guy going around kicking his dog in front of packed auditoriums, the truth is we still embrace much of the fundamental thinking behind his antics. For a long time now, we've considered ourselves exceptional beings at the center of a universe made up of identifiable parts, the whole lot of them there for the taking, a nature that seems more mechanism than organism. Even today, what Isaac Newton said 350 years ago, calling God, quote, a highly skilled mechanic, is still to many of us about right. The worldview laid down by the likes of Descartes and Newton, clever, precise, and in hindsight astonishingly overfocused and overconfident, didn't come out of nowhere for some 2,000 years. Getting to the ultimate truth of nature has meant casting our focus out there, using our minds to break things down into categories and component parts. And that approach, which Descartes and others of his day supercharged with some amazing mathematics, moved quickly out of the realm of theory, of intellectual story, to become reality itself. If you couldn't establish the clear physical boundaries of a thing, hold it outside yourself, fixed in time and space, then it didn't exist. The universe was real only to the extent that it could be objectively studied, measured, and ultimately predicted. Yet getting hyper-focused on discrete objects, coming to believe that kind of structuring held the key to the whole story of everything, dimmed our ability to perceive dynamic relationships. And that would cause us, is causing us, to miss an extraordinarily important fundamental truth about nature, which is that no life exists except through vast, dynamic webs of connection. So this subject-object thinking that Descartes helped entrench, which was very useful and we still use it to great ends and great technological breakthroughs all the time, it came with very heady illusions of control. It had very little respect for the mystery we were talking about earlier. And as I said at the end of that reading, it makes us slow to realize about the fact of life, that life only exists and only thrives through connection. It was a way of becoming obsessed with the parts and losing our perception of the whole. There's tremendous wisdom in the reality of our connection, and that's where this book goes after mystery next, into connection. I want to tell you a short story. A couple of you have probably heard me tell this before. Back in the 1920s, there was an anthropologist in Boston named Beckworth. And Beckworth was an eager young scholar looking to make his mark in the world. And at one point, he was sent west to California to document the Pitt River Indians, their lifestyle, their language, because the Pitt River Indians were not doing well, and it was thought that they would perhaps be extinct in a matter of decades. So Beckworth got out there, and he was a cordial fellow and respectful of the tribe. And he spent many months out there sitting with them, making notes, trying to translate their language, asking them about their social practices and describing and drawing their dress and their art. And at one point, after he'd been there for several months, he was with a group of elder men, and he finally got the courage to say, "I wanted to ask you what your word is for newcomers to the continent, newcomers from England and Europe, like me, like my people, my kin." And the elder men just really didn't want to answer that question. They kind of looked at each other and rolled their eyes, and he cajoled them and said, "You know, I understand there's great hard feelings with, you know, logically there would be, but still, you can trust that I won't be offended. I'd love to know what the word is." And so finally the eldest man said, "Our word for you is inlari." And I can just imagine Beckworth thinking, "Oh, that's a beautiful word." But if he said so, the elders would have gone, "It's not really such a beautiful word." And finally the elder who had told him about inlari said, "This is the thing. We see your people moving through the landscape at great speed, never stopping to make relationships with the plants, with the animals, with the people who call those places home. We don't understand how anyone could live that way without those connections. We think a part of you must be dead inside." And that's the word we have for that. And that is a major consequence, I would argue, for getting stuck in separation thinking. Again, what subject-object thinking gave to the world has been profound, but at the point we believed it was the only way of seeing, we sentenced ourselves to a very frustrating and dangerous way of living, and the dangers of which are only now really showing up. I wanted to also take one quick aside here. You know, to be fair, the experience of separation thinking isn't just something we got handed down in such abundance and through every institution we've ever been a part of, whether it's our university systems or anything else. That's reason enough to be steeped in it. But we're also prone as human beings to go through a separation stage as part of development. And because Mary is a developmental psychologist, I would like to pass the buck and have her tell you, if you don't mind, surprise, coming up here and telling you how that gets started, because I think it's really quite interesting to understand how it gets entrenched in human beings, besides just the heritage of the scientific thought.
Good to stand with you, author. It's good. Thanks, yeah. Honey. Yeah, this thing, it's not a tendency. We could not be in this room with each other. We could not be listening to one another and comprehending this level of discussion if each of us hadn't been through this stage. And the fact of the matter is, by the time we're 12, cognitive and developmental psychologists are showing us we have the capacity for abstraction, but we first have to go through this crazy experience of believing we're an individual separate from everything else. It goes kind of like this. If you imagine a baby in a high chair, and that baby is munching on blueberries, and you pick up one of her brightly colored toys, say a rattle, and you shake it in front of her, and she giggles. And then you hide it. And she's a young enough infant that when you hide it, she's like, meh. You know, she acts as if it never existed. She shows no interest because out of sight, out of mind. She has yet to develop the ability to think of herself as separate. For her, she's everything. She's the one who cries. She's the one who comforts her. It just doesn't ever occur to her. But one day you shake that same rattle, and when you hide it underneath the tray, she has a different response. You've probably seen this, those of you who are parents. She frowns. She makes complaining sounds. She looks to see where it is. That's the first little sprout of ego, the first glimmer of a separate self, self separate from everything else. If you don't have that experience, you can't move beyond it. Humans just have to have that experience. Here's the bad news. When you spend any time there, you get really seduced into thinking that you can and must control things. And if we all tell the truth about our lives, hardly any of us has moved beyond that. I mean, because we can abstract, but we still, I mean, practically, we stop at stop signs, you know, so we have to have that sense, oh, that's separate from me, that car is separate from my car, I'm stopping. So there's nothing dysfunctional about it. But when we make all of our decisions, it's a very frightening place to be. If you feel like you're an individual separate from everything else, that's really vulnerable. And so what we're developing in full ecology is putting this conservation science, this, in putting legs on it. What does it take for human beings to go beyond reading a book and go, I got it, and then doing the same stuff? You know, what does it take for us really to shift, to think more reflexively from our connection with all things instead of from this really fearful separation? Did I do okay?
Thank you, Dr.
Okay.
Claire. Thank you. That's very, very helpful. I still think about that. So, separating things can be useful. Great way to study. Great way to get their essential qualities and ultimately predict what they will do. And that's, of course, what technology is built on. But it sort of got out of control thanks to the first few hundred years of modern science. And at the same time, we've got this developmental stage that Mary was talking about that we often can get encouraged to stay stuck in. That's the way a lot of things get sold to us, is to exploit that notion that we're separate and we don't really feel like we belong and we need to control. And, oh, here's the product that will help you do that. It's a very powerful message. But the fact of the matter is, we're back to this. There's no such thing on planet Earth as a rugged individual. Nowhere. Not in the ocean, not in the prairie, not in the jungle, not in the desert, not in the mountains. No such thing as a rugged individual. If we were to go to Africa right now, we'd find olive baboons drinking from water holes that the elephants had dug. And then while the elephants drink, the olive baboons climb up to the top of the trees to warn the elephants of approaching lions. Over in Yellowstone, we can see ravens sometimes guiding wolf packs to a carcass, an elk carcass, because she will never be able to tear that carcass open on her own. So she shows them where it is. They tear it open and she feeds when they're done. When you go out and walk among trees, with every exhale, you give off the carbon dioxide, which is exactly what they need, just as you take in the oxygen they give off. And now we know it isn't just oxygen-carbon dioxide exchange. Those trees are giving off chemicals called phytoncides, which with every breath are showing themselves to fortify your immune system and strengthen your heart and vital organs. The sun coming up, falling on your skin, not only helps create the vitamin D that allows you to walk and stand and sit upright by maintaining your bones, it also, that sunlight falling on your body and in your eyes helps set the melatonin levels that will allow you to sleep at night. You're sitting there right now with, oh my God, anywhere from 50 to 200 million kinds of microbes in your stomach and your gut. None of those particular ones came into this world with you. They came to live with you after you were here. And in exchange for what you're feeding them, they're breaking down the nutrients that you eat and allowing those nutrients to be put where they're most needed, from your brain to your heart, to your vital organs, to your muscles, to your lymph system. So connection is is a thing. It's reality. And while separation thinking is useful, it really does not make room, or it has not thus far, for that particular reality. The world is a symphony of creative, dynamic connections. We can get beyond this. It isn't an easy thing to do. We can claim a bigger view, though, and as we do, the good news, the reward, is there's a wonderful amount of life and vigor and vitality to be found in broaching the separation thinking, in starting to see relationally, in experiencing our kinship with the planet. This is time for a whole explosion of perception fueled by the art that's being made, the poetry that's being written. This is a time to really reclaim and to take what I consider an evolutionary step in putting our self-reflective thinking, which nature has given us as a skill, not into enforcing ourselves against elusive threats, but rather to open ourselves up to more sustainable ways of living. Kinship is a kind of nourishment, and I think that this is where the energy will come for us, not to come up with the technical solutions for climate change. We've really got a lot of those in place already, but to fuel the kind of activity that's necessary to put those things into place, to build a society that's going to respect the planet and all its life forms. That's going to take a lot of commitment, and that kinship energy can make it seem less like a sacrifice than an honor, than a giving to a familial set of connections. So I'm going to finish this here with this reading with a little bit from the end of the book. And then if anyone has any questions, happy to turn those over to Mary and we can go from there. Okay. Wisdom expresses itself in humans and elephants and chimpanzees and wolves and so many others too. Life resting in the power of relationship, of kinship. Across most of human society, the idea of kinship isn't limited to blood relationships. It has to do as well with bonds formed with the people who simply share our lives, those with whom we eat, work, cry, raise our children. In some cultures, this sense of community even includes people who died long ago. For the people of these cultures, a gratitude arises from the fact that no matter their own accomplishments, they stand fully and forever on the shoulders of those who went before. Among the Kuwaru people of New Guinea, kinship arises by way of something called kalpong, which is said to be a substance originating in the soil. And while a father's sperm and mother's milk contain kalpong, so do the locally grown sweet potatoes and the pigs being raised in the village. Just the act of sharing those foods makes people kin no less so than a child is kin to the mother who gave him birth. Our task now, with the help of nature's lessons, and with the help, too, of the wisest human elders among us, is to grow our notions of kinship, to go beyond blood ties and the commons of place, beyond species even, to launch a sharing both humble and strong enough to honor the earth and all the life it holds. We can certainly end up at arm's length from nature by virtue of struggling with all that seems to demand our attention, by a life and a world that seems to pulse ever louder and faster. But at the same time, I suspect our distance is furthered by a growing sadness, even guilt, about what's happening to our planet, about the wildfires ravaging our communities, the hurricanes and storm events intensified by the things we humans have done. We don't much like these feelings. The rush of everyday life makes it all too easy to avoid this sadness and guilt, and at the same time avoid the very relationships with Earth that can help us. This is what psychologists call unprocessed loss, and right now it's calling us to engage in a kind of grief journey, a reconciliation, a heartfelt, intentional walk into the sticky shame we sometimes feel about how we've let our planet down. But while it's helpful for us to take ownership, to sit for a time with our feelings of regret, there's also this truth. Despite the theatrics of the evening news portraying hurricanes and wildfires as nature's wrath, nature does not loathe humans for the oppression and harm we've leveled against it. Loathing and fury and wrath are finally ours alone. Earth carries on, waxing and waning, ebbing and flowing, warming and flowering. Beauty is right here within easy reach. You can feel it under the branches of an old maple tree on a summer afternoon, when in a kind, gentle startle, it dawns on you that there's no action for you to take, no problem to solve, no plans to make, only the shade, the sun, the sound of the breeze in the leaves, and an extraordinary and effortless exchange. You, with every breath out, nurturing the tree in turn giving oxygen for your next breath. And so the world turns, and so you turn the world. Thank you very much for coming tonight. May I entertain you and your comments, questions, conversations with each other? I'd love to know what you're thinking and what you're wondering about, what you're struggling with. Yes, Kate.
Translate this into a children's book.
Into a children's book. That's a grand idea. That. Thank you. No, that I hadn't really thought much about that, but it is a good idea. I think when we're kids, yeah, to have that notion of this is how reality is. This is how life on planet Earth works. It's not like we're pushing a religion. We're really pushing a set of delightful ecological brilliances. So yeah, that would be good. Yes, Valerie.
I was thinking how the Greek word for ecology is oikos, O-I-K-O-S, which means home. And I've always liked that idea of the harmony in the spheres.
Greek word for ecology is the word for home. That's, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Those Greeks had some good ideas. What I was saying and hoping is that by adopting a worldview that makes room for the critical nature and the reality of kinship, that life thrives, it comes back from great disruption, it's sustainable. The number one predictor of sustainability in any natural system is diversity, and that diversity is in a set of relationships that is remarkably full of kin, in my way of thinking. And they're showing this now in humans as well. Let me just talk for a second about that. The diversity and the kinship that exists, say, in scientific groups doing original scientific research. There was a study done of 1 million scientific papers, and by far the ones that were getting cited the most, in other words, had the highest level of reliability and had the greatest influence on the science, were the ones being made up of these of this diverse group of people from different racial backgrounds, gender differences, on and on and on. Because when we come together that way in a kind of kinship, we each have a different perspective of the world. And through those other perspectives, we're able to actually come up with more creative problem solving than we could otherwise. It's even now to the point where they're saying in jury trials, should you ever be unlucky enough to be on trial for a crime you didn't commit, you should hope that the jury is made up of people of various races, because they've found that those kinds of multicultural juries are, for whatever reason, somehow more attentive during the courtroom proceedings. They're able to recall what actually was said better and process the information during the deliberations. So again, that's a specific kind of kinship. But what I was really saying is, if we can make kinship and diversity priorities in how we see the world, reflecting the way the world actually works, then we can start to, I think, move forward technologically, and the decisions we make about the development we take on and the kinds of science we want to embrace and support and those kinds we don't, based on whether or not it's serving that essential kinship. And in the process of serving that kinship, I really believe there's a heart level satisfaction. Ultimately, when you go out there and realize how much of the world really has your back. You know, this world has your back. Now we know that, like I said, the chemicals are coming off the trees that actually strengthen our organs. We are really being well tended and well taken care of. And so the more we open ourselves up to those relationships, I think the more acting on behalf of the Earth, doing the hard things for climate change, will become less a sacrifice, because we're in service of really what feels to me increasingly like a family. We're all traveling this planet together in a very familial way. So, God, I'm sorry. I bet you're sorry you asked that question. What a long-winded answer. All over the map. Anybody else have anything to say? Or Yes.
I have a personal question that I'm going to file under kinship, but you don't have to answer it. But I was just wondering how you and Mary met.
Well.
By accident.
It was by accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
There was a professor in Oregon, and a writer in Montana, 900 miles apart. And it was only because he plays a really good blues harmonica. That's weird.
That's weird.
So
I was playing in a band, blues harmonica, in Red Lodge with a guy who happened to go to college with Mary. And he'd been inviting her for 20 years to come meet his family, and it never worked. And that particular spring in 2013, she had it with Oregon Rain and, let's say, university politics, and decided she needed a break. So she drove 900 miles to meet Joe. And
with a full moon.
Full moon. And Joe alerted me that I've got a buddy. He said, I've got a buddy from college coming over for a few days. Do you want to come to dinner? And I thought, yeah, some, you know, hairy guy with no hair, not balding, that Joe went to college with. And he'd probably be a really nice guy because Joe is. But there was Mary. And so it wasn't a hairy guy at all. And so we started talking, and she left 2 days later, and in order to stay in touch. Oh, I'm so embarrassed to say that, but yeah, we spent for 6 weeks.
We shouldn't be telling all this. He set up his laptop so that when we got on Skype, we got hours, you know, it was courting, right? So that when Skype came on, he had his tea, I had my tea. And he had the fire right behind him.
Oh,
is that adorable?
Yeah. Oh, my God, this is going on the radio.
Too long.
You've got to edit
but
this.
I got to say a little more, Amy, about kinship and evolution. One of the things to keep in mind and to watch in yourself is the way we move from being something to having it. So we've always been in this kinship and always been in this interconnection. But until you see it, so until the baby could see that there was a rattle that was separate from her, she was just going to keep being everything. And then she moved into this ability to see, oh my gosh, things still exist when I can't see them. And then she starts crying when her parents are gone. Right? Before, meh. So we are moving. Climate change brings us right up next to this fact that, I mean, if right now were your last minute and you knew it, what would matter the very most to you? That's a relational question, probably. You have to answer it for yourself. But that's the question in front of us. So how do we be in our kinship by moving to have it, to see it, and to be responsible for it? So it is kind of, in that way, developmental and evolutionary. Thanks for letting me step
in. Yeah. That's good. So, yeah, we had a good meeting story. And that was in March, end of March. By August, we were engaged. By January 14th, we were married. So, you know, time's a wasting. You got it. Yes.
Are you going to translate this book for politicians?
This has been translated into nine different foreign languages, but I don't remember hearing that the politician language was included. Yeah. Well, that's something we need to keep working for, to elect people who really can see and respect the realities of our situation and act in our behalf and on behalf of the planet, too. And we need to be a lot more involved in doing that. It's time. It's past time.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the author James Howard Kunstler?
Yes.
You said that enthusiastically. I'm impressed. Listening to you this evening is a huge bouquet of hope.
Oh.
In the ecology and the union and the force that it could possibly create. Listening to Kunstler in The Long Emergency doesn't give you that hope. How do you bring the two together?
Say some more about what Kunstler leaves you with, what you walk away with from that.
What I walk away from Kunstler with is what the petroleum age has allowed human population to become at the expense of environment. And in the end, what the crash of the end of the age of petroleum will leave behind as an overpopulated, destitute world.
And that could be exactly right. You know, it's hard to say. However, I do think that to the extent that any of us can individually inspire and empower ourselves to do that, which we can do in a given day, in a given week, in a given life, that leans toward a different outcome. Even though if we're not guaranteed that those actions we're taking will, in fact, save the species or the world in the end, the species, because the world will actually be fine, I think there's such deep pleasure and beauty, as poignant as it would be if we don't manage to make it, in that alignment, that it changes nothing in the end for me, whether or not the future is going to be a disaster, whether the future is going to be something much better. I do continue to hope it's going to be something much better, but that does not drive the decisions I make on a daily basis, because those rewards aren't just for future generations. Those rewards are right now for us. They're right now for us.
Your enthusiasm is infectious.
Thank you for that question. It's a really important one, because it's easy to pick up all kinds of books and think, oh, why bother? Mm-hmm. Why bother? But that's, yeah.
Skype was mentioned earlier, and we're here talking about nature, and I'm just curious as to your thoughts on that intersection.
Between nature and...
You talked about Skype, the technology.
Technology, as we all know, can be something that brings us together. And there have been, I would argue, lots and lots of instances where people around the world have been brought together at very critical times, fighting for their democracy, for instance, by virtue of those technologies. And the way we stay in touch with pictures of cats and things like that every day, it's marvelous. However, one of the big dangers is, given where we came from, given the separation thinking heritage of subject-object science, I think it's extraordinarily easy to make the assumption that technology is going to save us. And technology will only reflect who we are as people and how we've put our self-critical minds to work. So I think technology can either be a boon or it can be a disaster. I do think it's quite fascinating now, the deep research that's coming on, saying if you can just unplug for even 20 minutes a day, 20 or 30 minutes a day, leave your small screen behind and have some sort of encounter with the natural world, there's a profound way that the beauty of the natural world seems to, without fail, for most people, push us off center stage. Because mostly we go through life where we're the star of the show. You know, the universe is like flowing through us. Nature and beauty and putting the screen down allow the opportunity to get nudged to the edge of the stage, where you're looking at the action somewhat as a participant observer, not just the star of the show. And it leaves us not only off the side of the stage, but really happy to be there. It's a remarkable mindset that's now being documented with actual chemical changes and neuronal changes that go on in the mind when you do engage just for 20 minutes. And I think what it allows you to do is then go back to your life, which may involve a lot of technology, and be refreshed and be in proper relationship with that technology. There's something called, psychologists refer to as soft fascination. When we go out into the world, it's like Einstein. He's not going to be able to figure it all out, so he gets to a higher place above it and lets the mystery of it and the mechanism of it sort of flow past him. And I think that's part of this rebooting that scientists are seeing from people taking a break from their small screens. So not a totally satisfying answer, but yeah, it's something I think we have to steer instead of be steered by. And right now I think it's the latter as often as the former. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming and supporting this bookstore and being a part of what I really feel so intensely as a newcomer. This is a special town. This is a special town with an energy and an impulse to connect around things that have a lot to do with quality of life that is inspiring to an incredible degree. So feed yourself, nourish yourself, and keep that going. And thanks for sharing place with me and helping Mary and I make it our place. All right. Thank you.
You You have just heard a reading by local science writer Gary Ferguson, recorded at the Country Bookshelf on the evening of November 5th, 2019. He was joined at times by his wife, cultural psychologist Mary Claire. Gary Ferguson's latest book, The Eight Master Lessons of Nature, What Nature Teaches Us About Living Well in the World, is just published by Dutton. You can find out more about their work by going to fullecology.com. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.